This weekend, Hollywood's biggest movie release is set in 10,000 BC, but two other period movies strike critic Bob Mondello as more interesting. He says both play with movie styles that have mostly gone out of fashion.
The Bank Job takes a nugget of fact, a 1971 robbery that became known as the walkie-talkie bank heist, and tunnels with it straight into a kind of fiction that used to be popular in the 50s and 60s, the serious heist movie. More recently, say in Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, heists have tended to be caper comedies with just a bit of suspense. This one makes nods in that direction, but what gives the movie its kick is what made the real crime remarkable at the time. The robbers posted a lookout, and he had, back in the days before cell phones, a big, clunky, two-way radio.
I'm up on the roof, and I've got a good view.
All directions.
The robbers figured this gave them an advantage. They could see the police coming. What they didn't figure on was that a ham radio operator would hear them and inform the police.
Sergeant, we just heard. The thief's lookout says there are police outside the bank right now.
Which bank?
I haven't got a clue.
We've got patrols outside half the banks in the West End. Keep listening.
Director Roger Donaldson and his writers take a long time to set all this up, and most of the setup and even the robbery itself isn't nearly as sharply paced as the mad dash that happens after the heist, but if the bank job rarely feels terribly urgent, it's still fun in a pleasantly old-fashioned way. Older fashioned still is Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, a sort of 1940s mistaken identity comedy in which no one is quite who she appears to be. Not Guinevere Pettigrew, the prim, frumpish nanny played by Frances McDormand, who's living on Skid Row when she takes a social secretary job she's not remotely qualified for. And certainly not Delicia LaFosse, the ditzy showgirl who hires Miss Pettigrew almost entirely for effect. Delicia, played by Amy Adams, Delicious Lee, is all about effect.
Didn't you catch every day's a holiday? One of mine.
Mae West.
Oh, you did see it?
Oh, yes, which part were you?
I was in the restaurant scene. In the back.
Really?
Behind the palm tree, drinking a margarita.
I
think they cut that for the European print. A little Detroit for you English, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
now, in a 40s comedy about a frump and a showgirl, the frump must bloom and the showgirl gets shown up. The only real question is how long it will take after they shed their false pretenses for the men in their lives to realize how splendid they are. Rather a lot of men in Delicia's case. She's juggling the attentions of a theater producer she's sleeping with, a nightclub owner she's living with, and a seriously frustrated pianist who actually loves her.
How'd you take your whiskey?
He does seem to be a little agitated about something.
Well, I'm afraid that might be my fault.
Ice pick?
It's in the drawer. Ice in the frigidaire.
And what, the pig for murder, not ice?
See? Such a hothead. He takes love so seriously.
Is that a problem?
Of course it's a problem.
Nothing in director Bharat Naluri's credits, which include TV's Tsunami The Aftermath, suggests that he'd be someone who could, say, mimic Blake Edwards' timing or George Cukor's fashion sense, but he proves clever in harking back to the sort of Hollywood comedy where cocktail parties passed for plot devices. That sort of film needs grounding these days, something Frances McDormand helps with here. Just watch her face when the sound of bombers flying overhead draws partiers to a balcony and reminds you that the Blitz will soon dim London's lights. But that's another day. Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day is about comic effervescence, and with McDormand and Amy Adams on hand, the form still has some fizz. I'm Bob Mondello.
Paranoid Park is a new film directed by Gus Van Sant, based on a young adult novel by Blake Nelson. At the Cannes Film Festival last May, the jury awarded Van Sant with a special prize for the film. Paranoid Park is set in the world of teenage skateboarders in Portland, Oregon. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Gus Van Sant embodies the notion of the director as conceptual artist. He regards everything he does as some kind of experiment. His first film, Mala Noche, was a tale of romantic obsession that played like an expressionist fever dream. Then came Drugstore Cowboy, outrageous in its premise, the addict as Western outlaw, but conventional in technique. Then My Own Private Idaho, conventional in its theme of teen alienation, but outrageous in technique, a mix of Shakespeare, surrealism, and urban grit. When Van Sant made formula studio pictures like Good Will Hunting, he told interviewers he was working in the tradition of Renaissance artists who strived to suppress their personal voices. I'm not kidding. A remake of Hitchcock's Psycho posed the question, if you replicate a film shot by shot, what will you wind up with? It turns out, nothing pretty. Paranoid Park belongs in the series that began with Van Sant's Jerry and continued with Elephant and The Last Days, trance-like works in which you drifted through time and space with non-actors, or actors behaving like non-actors. This is the best of those freeform works, a supernaturally perfect fusion of his art project head trip aesthetic and Blake Nelson's finely tuned first-person young adult novel. The protagonist and narrator, Alex, played by Gabe Nevins, is a Portland, Oregon teen whose father has moved out and who gravitates toward a grotty skate park for what he calls, in voiceover, thrown-away kids. One day, Alex gets called to the school office, where a detective, played by Dan Liu, asks about a grisly death near Paranoid Park.
Let me tell you what my situation is. I have the security guard, and we find him deceased on the railroad tracks. And so we're thinking maybe he tripped or he fell. But the autopsy says he was struck by an object. And we also have a witness that says he saw somebody throw something over the bridge into the river. We happen to have that object, and it's a skateboard. Now, the funny thing is, there's some DNA evidence on the skateboard that puts it at the scene of the crime. Where did you go?
I drove around downtown a little to Subway and got something to eat.
Okay, there's about 1,002 Subways. Which one did you go
to? By the waterfront.
Okay, and the one over in the World Trade Center, that one?
Yes.
Okay, what'd you get?
Turkey and ham on Italian herb and cheese bread, toasted tomato, lettuce, pickle, olive, mustard, oil, and vinegar.
Did you get mayo?
No.
Gotta have mayo with that.
Mayo's sick.
Mayo's sick. What kind of bread was it?
Italian herb and cheese.
Okay, you have a receipt in your pocket for that?
No, I don't keep Subway receipts.
Okay, how much did it cost then?
Like six something. Subway's expensive.
6 inch, 12 inch?
Six.
6 inch for $6, so you must have got the meal then, right?
No, I just got a drink.
Okay.
All large, right. Dr. Pepper.
Who'd you eat with?
Myself.
Based on his sandwich description, I'd believe Alex, but it turns out via flashback that he was at the scene of the death, although guilt or innocence are inadequate to describe what he did. Although he longs to tell someone, his father, who seems oblivious to his needs, or even that detective, he pulls into himself. Nelson's book is linear and even invokes Dostoevsky, since Alex is reading Notes from Underground. Van Sant dumps Dostoevsky and ruptures the narrative line to drive home Alex's inability to get at his own mixed-up feelings. The director and cinematographer Christopher Doyle leap from the static and realistic to the dreamlike and woozy, with Super 8 skateboard footage that seems to bubble up from the collective unconscious of the misfits of Paranoid Park. The soundtrack is a vivid mashup, Beethoven, country, the melancholy Elliott Smith, capped with Nina Rota's carnivalesque Fellini music, which drowns out Alex's cheerleader girlfriend. Van Sant found his leading actor from a casting notice on MySpace, and Nevins has a good soft face, a 7-year-old's head on a 17-year-old's body. There are times when his inexpressiveness is a little too inexpressive, but the voiceover narration keeps the movie grounded, and Alex's tumultuous emotions are right there in the film's look and sound. In life, when you look at a teenage boy with no expression, his clothes drooping, his long hair in his eyes, perhaps toting a skateboard, you might construe his blank affect as a sign of the blankness within. But in Van Sant's hands, that supposed void turns out to be not too empty, but too full. Paranoid Park is a trip into space, not outer, but inner, in ways that movies rarely are. This time, the experiment is a raging success.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Paranoid Park opens today in New York and L.A. and can also be seen in the pay-per-view section of many cable systems as part of the series called IFC in Theaters. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
And if you aren't a fan of The Wire or somehow miss the phenomenon, Hollywood has plenty of other options on the big screen for you this weekend. Here with his weekly look at what the critics think is Mark Jordan Ligon with Slate Summary Judgment.
Oh, what a cinematic grab bag lies before you. Everything from Martin Lawrence in a G-rated Disney movie to a 1970s London bank heist to prehistoric hotties. Where to begin? With former wild and raunchy stand-up Martin Lawrence now playing the lovable and bumbling dad, of course. Yes, the family comedy College Road Trip is here with overprotective Papa insisting on escorting his daughter, played by Raven Simone, to tour prospective colleges. Donny Osmond, yes, you heard me, Donny Osmond also stars, and he doesn't play himself.
You can be chief at the station, but you have to be dad at home. Yes,
Surprise! Road trip! Road trip! Yeah!
Oh, no.
Most of the nation's critics moan, oh no, as well. Variety snaps, this overplayed, underachieving laugher feels thoroughly manufactured, and USA Today finds College Road Trip humorless and massively predictable. Next up is the true story crime thriller The Bank Job, based on the infamous 1971 Lloyd's of London robbery. Jason Statham heads the crew that wants to pull off the perfect heist.
So we're going to sit here all night making small talk?
I know you, Terry. And I know your mates. You've always been looking for the big score. The one that makes sense of everything. I have it for you.
What?
A bank.
Bloody good, shout the critics. Rolling Stone cheers a juicy caper movie full of surprises. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer finds The Bank Job highly entertaining. And the New York Observer shouts one of the liveliest entertainments of the year. And for those of you longing for the TV show Cavemen to return, well, here's the prehistoric adventure 10,000 BC. From the director of Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow comes the story of a handsome hunter-gatherer trying to rescue his true love while battling hairy warlords and CGI saber-tooth thingies.
When the sun rises, we will join our brothers and sisters on the mountain of the god and convince them to fight with us together. As one!
Wow, that sounds like Paleolithic Braveheart. While the Associated Press grunts a mix of vast CGI spectacle and small silly moments, and the New York Times calls 10,000 BC sublimely dunderheaded, the Chicago Tribune enjoys the ride. Sometimes you have a hankering for a slab of 10,000-year-old cheese. Here it is, on a cracker. Yeah, I just think it's great that so many young people will go to this and really learn what it was like back in 10,000 BC. Apparently, everyone had awesome abs with really cool prehistoric hair extensions, making them look like really cool prehistoric yoga teachers. Of course, the yoga mat hadn't been invented yet. And everything that could eat you was saber-tooth, which is true. Back then, saber-toothed everything. Saber-toothed tiger, even saber-toothed chicken. It's true. I saw it on the internet.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer who dreams of grilling saber-toothed chicken in his Los Angeles backyard.
Our program is produced by Chip Grabo and edited by Rick Holter. The director is Shireen Meraji.
The day-to-day production staff includes Catherine Fox, Steve Proffitt, Deborah Clark, Martina Castro, Ki-Min Sung, Nihar Patel, Vanessa Romo, and Jolie Myers.
Our editors are Martha Little, Jacob Conrad, Sarah Spivak, and Laura Dine. Our technical director is Leo Delagula, with engineer Sean Corey Campbell.
The day-to-day theme song was composed by Greg Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Rogers.
And we'll move from Afghanistan, a place where the past is always present, to your local movie theater, where a film gets its material from the past. It comes from writer-director Roland Emmerich, who's responsible for Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow. He's taken audiences to a lot of strange places, but critic Kenneth Turan says not one of them was as strange as his 10,000 BC.
10,000 BC is as crazy as it wants to be. It plunders the past and plunders other movies with that peculiar Hollywood combination of the earnest and the preposterous that has to be seen to be believed. Who knew, for instance, that woolly mammoths were used to build the pyramids? True story. The idea behind 10,000 BC is that the Ice Age is not a time, but a place that people could simply walk out of if they had a heck of a good reason to hit the trail. Our hero, the hunter Delaire, has that reason. His beloved Evelyn has been kidnapped by a band of marauding slave traders.
Evelyn!
So Delaire starts walking, encountering everything from saber-toothed tigers to a flock of enormous and quite hostile chickens. He ends up in a proto-Egyptian civilization run by effete priests who are dead ringers for refugees from Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. Naturally, he leads a revolt.
We will join our brothers and sisters on the mountain of the god and convince them to fight with us.
Together, as one!
More than anything, 10,000 BC is an updated version of those old Saturday matinee action films. It's filled with hairsbreadth escapes, wild coincidences, things foretold by ancient prophecy, and mysterious places from which no one has ever returned. 10,000 BC even employs the veteran Omar Sharif to read a pious voiceover that relies on sentiments like, "Only time can teach us what is truth and what is legend." The Oracle, friends, has spoken.
Kenneth Duran is Movie Oracle for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. The director of a film about radio, Talk to Me, has been talking with us for the radio. Her name is Casey Lemons, and she is the latest Hollywood movie maker we've brought in to share DVD recommendations. She has divided her picks into categories like this. The category is plain cool, and would you please pronounce the name of the movie for me?
Francis.
I can't do it either. That's why I dumped it over to you. It's French. 36. Let's, we can do that in English. 36. And what about the rest of it here?
Quai de Frères? Is that how you say it? I don't know.
It sounds good to me. Since we had that conversation, someone put a pronunciation guide in front of me, so let's try this. Francis Quai de Fevre, more or less. It's the title of the film and the French equivalent of Scotland Yard. Its director spent 12 years as a French cop. And our director, Casey Lemons, puts this movie high on her list of DVD choices. She also offers what she calls DVDs I can watch over and over, beginning with the 1971 film Harold and Maude.
That's maybe my favorite. Just perfect kind of tone, a very delicate balance.
Describe what it's about for people who've never seen this movie.
For people who've never seen Harold and Maude, it's a love story between a very kind of suicidal young rich boy, about 16, and a 80-year-old woman.
And when did you first see this movie?
I first saw it as a kid, and I don't know, for some reason it just kind of tickled my perverse funny bone. I really related to it. And the music, of course, is wonderful. It's Cat Stevens, fabulous, fabulous soundtrack. And I was very moved by this character that Bud Cort plays, this young man who's always trying to get his mother's attention by staging suicides.
Is that the part that you related to?
In some ways I did. I thought it was great kind of teen angst. You know, I felt for him.
Do you enjoy... Harold, please. Do you have ups and downs without obvious reason? That's you, Harold.
Now, how did this next movie get onto your list here? All That Jazz.
All That Jazz is a wonderful movie that is semi-autobiographical about Bob Fosse and his kind of journey through choreography.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Play back, Victoria. Play back.
And wrestling with his own demons and his health scare at that time, which I guess he'd had a massive heart attack.
This is a real famous Broadway choreographer.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, the doctors.
I'm Dr. Hyman, the internist.
I'm Dr. Ballinger, the cardiologist.
5, 6, 7, 8.
The heart is the viscous of cardiac muscle that maintains
oxygen blood from the blood.
That means he had total blockage in...
two arteries.
It's a musical, and it's very, it has a wonderful kinkiness, you know, just in terms of creating his life in a musical and the dark side of musical comedy and his kind of twisted romantic relationships. And I love this movie.
Well, now, I would have thought that the word kinky would be more likely to be applied to Last Tango in Paris, which you've also listed as one of your DVD choices.
Yeah, in some ways, with Last Tango in Paris, it's the music and the mood and Paris and certain scenes that are just incredibly vivid and wonderful for me, like, you know, Marlon Brando talking to his dead wife.
You lied to me, and I trusted you. You lied. You knew you were lying. Go on, tell me you didn't lie. Haven't you got anything to say about that? You can think up something, can't you? Huh? Go on, tell me something sweet. Smile at me and say I just misunderstood. Go on, tell me.
So you've given us DVDs that you can watch over and over again. I don't know if you can watch these over and over again, but you've described them as underappreciated DVDs. One of them is called Sugarcane Alley.
Sugarcane Alley is a film by Uzan Palsy, just telling a story from a child's point of view. The child in Sugarcane Alley is a little boy in Martinique.
Are we on sugar plantations in the Caribbean? Is that what it is?
Yeah, and you track him through school and his relationship with his grandmother and in his small community. It's a wonderful, wonderful film.
And Daughters of the Dust, you've also called an underappreciated DVD.
Daughters of the Dust is another film that was hugely influential over me. It was like somebody that was speaking my language. You know, it's a very evocative film that unfolds kind of slowly and is very mythical. And that's something that I really relate to.
My story begins on the eve of my family's migration north. My story begins before I was born. My great-great-grandmother, Nana Pazant, saw her family coming apart, her flowers to bloom in a distant frontier.
I think these are both great rentals if you wanted to go out and grab a couple of DVDs and just have a totally enchanted night. I would rent Sugarcane Alley and Daughters of the Dust.
Well, Casey Lemons, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Casey Lemons' full list of favorite DVDs is at NPR.org.
Skiers have reason to rejoice this winter. There's a lot of snow on the mountains, the largest cover in at least 20 years. And for those who live for the thrill of a steep run on good powder, it's heaven. Armchair ski enthusiasts can experience that thrill. In a movie theater now, Steep, a film about the history of extreme skiing, features some of the sport's most serious devotees, guys like Glenn Plake.
As soon as I got out of jail, I went skiing. As soon as I got out of broken legs, I went skiing. That's where I had to go to make it all right again.
Glenn Plake was featured in the 1988 ski movie Blizzard of Oz. A new generation of skiers was inspired by that movie, skiers like Ingrid Backstrom. She's profiled in Steep, and she's one of the world's best free skiers, and as they say in the movie, she rips. Backstrom is on the line from Haines, Alaska. Hey, Ingrid.
Hi, Leanne. Thanks for having us.
A pleasure. You say us because you're joined there by Scott Gaffney. He's the creative director for Matchstick Productions, the man who discovered you. Hi, Scott.
Hi there.
All right. So what are you two doing right now in Haines, Alaska?
We basically woke up early this morning. We are prepping to go out for a shooting day if the weather holds for us.
A shooting day? You're making a movie?
We are making a movie. It's kind of our annual thing each year. We're just trying to gather as much footage throughout the year and put a movie together through the summer and release it around in September.
Okay, so it's ski movie season, and the star of this shoot is you, Ingrid?
Well, I'm here. There's a couple skiers here, but I'm lucky enough to be one of them.
All right, what are you going to be doing for this movie?
Hopefully get on some cool mountains with good features, lots of nice powder, and hopefully make it look good and look fun and make people want to go watch it.
I'm trying to imagine where you are. I mean, Haines, Alaska, you've got your ski gear on. What are you looking at? What are the mountains you're looking at right now?
Well, it's sort of not quite light yet, so we can't really see many mountains at the moment, but when it gets blue later on today, I mean, there are just the most stunning mountains here.
everyone in the movie and in the extreme ski community, I imagine, they all talk about what a powerful experience it is to be in the mountains.
When you're always in that element, the vertical world, either skiing or climbing, moving through the mountains, not just being in them, but actually moving through the mountains and with the mountains, you're only a guest.
Ingrid, how would you describe your relationship with a mountain?
Well, to me, mountains give me the ultimate sense of freedom. You take responsibility for all of your own actions, but yet you get to pretty much do whatever you want. The sky's the limit, I guess.
Yeah. We see you in Steep. It's 2004 footage, and it was shot in Bella Coola, British Columbia. It's an incredibly steep run, and you blew everybody away.
Well, it was my first film shoot with Matchstick, and I was just, I guess, kind of eager to get out there, and we had perfect conditions that day. And Scott actually helped me pick out that line. So I got up there, and I don't know, everything just kind of fell into place. It was a great run.
Yeah, you have to choreograph these runs before you actually do them. Is that right, yeah. Scott?
Yeah, you pretty much have to study. When you're at the bottom of something, you're looking up, and you see all these rocks, and your ways around the rocks, your ways off the rocks. But then you get to the top, and it's a totally different perspective, and so you have to have this mental image in your mind of exactly what you're skiing, or else you're going to get lost, and instead of going off a 20-foot cliff, maybe go off an 80-foot cliff.
Ingrid, I still have to ask you about that 2004 shot, and your partner goes down, and he starts cartwheeling down the mountain, the same run you're going to take. What was going through your mind when you were watching that?
Well, I think before that I was kind of just looking around at the scenery, like, doo-doo-doo, this is going to be fun, and then when I saw Hugo, you know, cartwheel out the bottom, all of a sudden it made me realize, okay, this is serious. I need to focus and concentrate here because Hugo, who never crashes, just crashed down the steep run. And I think it helped me, you know, get my mind in the right place.
Yeah, because really, I mean, you didn't really have an alternative but to go down, right?
No, I was there and there wasn't really any other way down.
Right. Now, you're not doing the kind of stuff that we see at the end of the movie where, oh, you know, we're going to go down this run, and it looks good, but there is a cliff at the end of it, so let's put a parachute in our ski gear.
No, I'm not doing that. Really not.
All right. Scott, have you filmed that? That's some of the more
I've filmed a lot of that. That's another guy, Shane McConkie, and T.T. Holmes, that we work a lot with. And you're out in all these mountains, and you see these lines that go down the mountain and then just end this terminal cliff, and there's no way to ski that line that's above it. And as a base jumper, he just figured, let's combine the two and ski these lines that no one has before.
Ingrid, you're one of the only a handful of women in this world. You're referred to as a big mountain skier chick, and that's a compliment. Has gender ever mattered?
Well, no. I've been really lucky. I have a great people to work with and a great crew, and when I think about going out and skiing in the morning, it's not like, what would a girl ski today? I just think of it as what I want to ski and what looks fun to me. And I'm lucky I have great support from my family and Matchstick and everyone involved.
Yeah. Are you seeing a lot more women when you're big mountain skiing?
Oh, yeah. There are so many great women right now doing it, and the contests, free skiing contests, are getting more popular. It's just awesome. It's a great time to be a big mountain ripper chick, as you say.
Ingrid Backstrom is one of the big mountain skiers featured in the movie Steep from Sony Pictures. Scott Gaffney is creative director for Matchstick Productions, an extreme sports film production company. They're both in their ski gear and joining us from the snows of Haines, Alaska. Thank you both. Have a good run.
Thank you very much. We'll hope for the best as well.
Yeah, thanks, Leanne. Enjoy your weekend.
To see some excerpts from Steep, you can check out our website at npr.org.